vampires are costly. Like, running Iraq is not cheap. Somebody's paying. People who the corporations that destroyed Iraq and the corporations who were rebuilding it. They're getting paid by the American taxpayer in both cases. So we pay them to destroy the country, and then we pay them to rebuild it.
That's Noam Chomsky, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Noam Chomsky on imperialism. Our fingers will be in every pie, declared Senator Robert Taft in the 1940s. 2 decades later, JFK announced, our frontiers today are on every continent. And indeed, it has come to pass. In mainstream media and scholarship, it's been rare to find the noun imperialism preceded by the adjective American. With a brazenness that would make Roman emperors blush, the U.S. asserts its interests and borders everywhere. The cover for aggression is cloaked in the lofty rhetoric of upholding U.N. Security Council resolutions, democracy, nation-building, and humanitarian intervention. Alan Murray, CNBC's Washington bureau chief, wrote in the Wall Street Journal, "We are all, it seems, imperialists now." He might be speaking for the elites that run America, not for voices of conscience like Noam Chomsky. Noam Chomsky, longtime MIT professor, is for many a symbol of resistance to tyranny and the depredations of state and private power. He was one of the first to speak out against the Vietnam War. Author of numerous books, including Propaganda and the Public Mind and 9/11, his latest is Hegemony or Survival. Businessweek says of Chomsky, with relentless logic, he bids us to listen closely to what our leaders tell us and to discern what they are leaving out. Agree with him or not, we lose out by not listening. I talked with him in his office at MIT on September 11th, 2003. Well, welcome to the program, Noam Chomsky.
Glad to be here again.
Let's talk about regime change, which is a new term in the lexicon, kind of like a change of address. It sounds somewhat innocuous. It certainly sounds a lot better than invasion, overthrow, and occupation. The U.S. is an old hand at regime change, and we're in a year that marks a couple of anniversaries. I'm particularly thinking of regime change in Iran. 50 years ago, August 1953, Operation Ajax, carried out by a CIA agent who was incidentally Teddy Roosevelt's grandson, overthrowing the conservative parliamentary democracy led by Mohammad Mossadegh and restored the Shah to the peacock throne where he ruled for the next 25 years. What does that regime change tell you about U.S. policy and what it is doing today in Iraq?
Well, that was back in 1953. The issue was that the conservative nationalist parliamentary government was attempting to take over its own oil resources. These were had been under the control of a British company called Anglo-Iranian, which had entered into contracts with the rulers of Iran, which were just pure extortion and robbery. I mean, the Iranians got nothing, and the British were laughing all the way to the bank. Mossadegh, who had a long history as a critic of this subordination to imperial policy, did finally manage to the popular outbursts compelled the Shah to appoint him as prime minister, and he moved towards to nationalize the industry, which makes perfect sense. The British went completely berserk. They refused to make any compromises. They wouldn't even come near what the American oil companies had just agreed with in Saudi Arabia. They wanted to continue just robbing the Iranians blind, and that led to tremendous popular uprising. Iran has a democratic tradition. It had a majlis of parliament, which went back and had always been suppressed, but was always in the background. The Shah couldn't suppress it. The army tried and couldn't. Finally, a joint British-American coup, they're both involved, did succeed in organizing an overthrow of the regime, restored the Shah to power, and then comes 25 years of terror, atrocities, violence, finally leading to the revolution in 1979, the overthrow of the Shah. But that's incidentally one outcome of the coup was that the United States took over from Britain about 40% of the share in Iranian oil. It had been 100% British. That wasn't actually the goal of the effort. It's just in the normal course of events. But it was part of the general displacement of British power by U.S. power in that region and, in fact, throughout the world, just sort of normal reflection of distribution of power elsewhere. The New York Times had a nice editorial about it in which they, I wish I could quote the exact words, but it was something like this. They said that they praised the coup. They said this should be a lesson to underdeveloped nations with rich resources that go berserk with radical nationalism. And it should teach other Mossadeghs elsewhere in the world that they should be careful before trying to do something like going berserk and gaining control of their own resources, which, of course, are ours, not theirs. Your point is quite correct. Regime change is normal policy. I mean, in fact, it's even perfectly conceded. So, for example, a couple of years ago, maybe 5 years ago, the European Union protested, brought to the World Trade Organization a complaint against the United States, this is during the Clinton years, for the extended economic warfare against Cuba, which extended to secondary boycotts, which are illegal under every possible interpretation of international law and have been condemned by every relevant institution. And they brought it to the World Trade Organization as restraint in trade. And the Clinton administration simply told them, again, I wish I could quote the wording, something like this. It said, Europe is challenging policies of ours which go back to 1959 and which are aimed at overthrowing the government of Cuba, regime change. And Europe has no business interfering in internal affairs of the United States like this. Actually, the State Department or whoever wrote that didn't know their own history very well. If you go back to the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, a period of real frenzy about regime change, which almost led to nuclear war, reason internally, the reason given by U.S. intelligence for regime change, overthrowing the Castro regime, was that the very existence of the Castro regime is successful defiance of a policy of the United States of 150 years, meaning back to the Monroe Doctrine. The policy of the United States is that we are the masters of the hemisphere, and the very existence of the Castro regime is successful defiance of this. So, of course, we have to overthrow it by a campaign of large-scale terror and economic warfare. What's interesting about this particular remark is that it's shortly after that a terrorist campaign, which was quite serious, aimed at regime change, almost led the world to a terminal nuclear war. It was a very close thing.
After World War I, the British occupied Iraq, and it faced, as one report says, anti-imperialist agitation from the start. And shaken by the revolt, the British felt it wise to put up a facade. And in the words of Lord Curzon, the foreign secretary, he said, Britain wanted, quote, an Arab facade ruled and administered under British guidance and controlled by a native Mohammedan and as far as possible by an Arab staff. Just jump fast forward today to Iraq with the appointment of a 25-person ruling council appointed by the American viceroy there, Paul Bremer.
Yeah, actually, that's Lord Curzon was very honest in those days. It was an Arab facade, and then they went on behind which Britain would rule behind a veil of constitutional fictions like buffer state and various other terms. But it would basically be an Arab facade, and that's the way Britain ran the whole region, in fact, the whole empire. The idea is to have independent states, but always weak governments, which rely on the imperial power for their survival. And they can rip off the population if they like, that's fine. But they have to be a facade behind which the real power rules. That's standard imperialism. Lord Curzon was simply being a little more honest than most. You can find plenty of examples. Paul Bremer's is one. There was a wonderful organization chart published in the New York Times. I think it might have been like May 7th or approximately then, just after Bremer was appointed. Unfortunately, it's not in the archived edition, so you have to look back at the hard copy. But it had a chart with, I think, 17 boxes or 16 boxes, something like that. That's a standard organization chart, somebody at the top and lines going down. At the top is Paul Bremer answering to the Pentagon. And then you go down various lines and you get to various generals and diplomats, all either U.S. or British. And the very bottom, and each one of them has the name, the responsibility in boldface. In a big box, the responsibility office. Then you get down to the bottom, and there's a 17th box at the bottom, half the size of the others, no bold face, no indication of responsibility, and this says Iraqi advisors. That's the facade. Since then, it was a mistake to publish it. I suppose that's why it didn't archive. But expresses the thinking, and it's Lord Curzon would have felt it quite normal. It's not clear that they can handle it, because I should say, to my amazement, the occupation is not succeeding. I mean, it takes real talent to fail on this. For one thing, military occupations almost always work. Like the Nazis in occupied Europe had very little trouble running the countries with collaborators. I mean, every country had plenty of collaborators who ran the place as a facade and kept order and kept the population down. And they were at the extreme level of brutality in history. Furthermore, they were under attack from the outside, and the resistance was being directed and supported from abroad, just like the Nazis claimed, terrorists supported from abroad, directed from London. Nevertheless, they, despite, if it hadn't been for the fact that they were crushed by overwhelming outside force, they wouldn't have any trouble running occupied Europe. I mean, the Russians had very little problem running Eastern Europe through facades. And again, that's another very brutal regime. In fact, if you look through history, it usually works. I mean, the cases where there's an uprising against imperial rule are pretty rare. I mean, something happens, but not the norm. Furthermore, this is an unusually easy case. I mean, here's a country which has been devastated by a decade of murderous sanctions, which killed hundreds of thousands of people and left the whole place in tatters, held together with scotch tape. That's after wars that devastated it, run by a brutal tyrant. I mean, it's hard not to do better than that. I mean, the idea that you can't get a military occupation to run under the, and of course no support from the outside for the resistance, none. I mean, it's just, I think it's almost unimaginable. I imagine if we got a couple of people on this floor together, probably figure out how to get the electricity running. So it is an astonishing failure, and certainly surprises me. But I think their original planning, as illustrated in that organization chart, amazingly doesn't look like it's going to work. Which is why you get all this backtracking about trying to get the UN to come in and pick up some of the costs and so on, and the domestic opposition, et cetera. It's a big surprise to me. I thought this would be a walkover.
Let's talk about another aspect of British imperialism, since that is our focus today, is on imperialism. In the title essay of Towards a New Cold War, which is being reissued by the New Press, you were writing about Jawaharlal Nehru, one of the leaders of the opposition to British rule in India. And he observed, in your writing, that the ideology of British rule in India, quoting Nehru, was that of the Heron folk and the master race, unquote, and an idea that is, quote, inherent in imperialism and was proclaimed in unambiguous language by those in authority and put into practice as Indians, as individuals, were subjected to insult, humiliating, and contemptuous treatment, unquote, of Nehru. Could you talk about that racism as being, quote, inherent in imperialism?
It's worth remembering that Nehru was pretty much an Anglophile, and I believe, if I remember, that he was writing that from a British jail during the Second World War. But yes, even the elite, he was from the elite Indian upper classes, and quite British in manner and style and so on. Could the humiliation and degradation is one of the hardest things to bear, and it's almost invariable. I mean, it's hard to think of cases where you don't find it. He's right, it's inherent in imperial rule, and I think you can understand the psychology. I mean, when you got your boot on somebody's neck, you can't just say, I'm doing this because I'm a brute, you know. You have to say, I'm doing it because they deserve it, you know, it's for their good. That's why I got their naughty children, as U.S. leaders described Latin Americans. They're naughty children who have to be disciplined. Filipinos were described in the same way. And therefore, you don't feel that you're humiliating a child if you don't let it, you know, eat poison or something. But that's inherent in the relation of domination. Unless you have unusual sensitivity, and ruling powers don't have that. They're run by people like Rumsfeld, you know, not by your friendly aunt. But so his comment is quite accurate, and it's very consistent. It's hard to think of an exception to that. It's exactly what's been going on in the occupied territories for years. I mean, one of the worst parts of the occupation has been the constant humiliation and degradation at every moment. Same in India.
Now, racism is inherent then in hegemony and imperial domination. What about the drive for resources?
Well, that's ordinarily, I mean, very consistently a factor in domination. I mean, it's not always the only factor. So, for example, the British desire to control Palestine wasn't because of Palestine's resources. It was because of its geostrategic position and so on. So there are lots of factors that enter into seeking domination and control. But resources are almost very commonly there. I mean, say the U.S. Takeover of Texas and around half of Mexico about 150 years ago. That's usually not called a resource war, but if you think about it, it was. You take a look back at the Jacksonian Democrats, you know, Polk and presidents of that time and other people, what they were trying to do. Was exactly what Saddam Hussein was accused of trying to do in 1990, except they were openly trying to do it. They were trying to get a monopoly over the world's major resource, which in those days was cotton. Cotton is what fueled the Industrial Revolution, just the way oil fuels the contemporary industrial world. And the U.S. had a lot of cotton, but not everything. And one of the goals in taking over Texas and particularly Texas, but also the rest, was to ensure that the U.S. could gain a monopoly of cotton and bring the British to our feet because we would control the resource on which they survive. You know, they're the leading industrial power, and the United States is then a minor industrial power. But it had this enormous resource, which the British need. So if we could control it, we'd bring them to their knees. And remember, Britain was the great enemy at the time. That was the powerful force that was preventing the United States from expanding north to Canada and south to Cuba and so on. It was a resource war in a deep sense, though there were other factors too. And it's not unusual to find that. There are other motives. Say, Israeli takeover of the West Bank is partially for the water resources which are needed, but goes way beyond that.
Paul Wolfowitz, who's the Deputy Defense Secretary and has been described as one of the main architects of the attack on Iraq, was in Singapore last June, and in response to an audience question asking why the United States went after Iraq instead of the truly dangerous North Korea, Wolfowitz said, and I'm quoting, "Let's look at it simply. The most important difference between North Korea and Iraq is that economically we just had no choice in Iraq. The country swims on a sea of oil," unquote.
Yeah, that's part of it. Now, the other part is that, which he knows very well, is that Iraq was completely defenseless, whereas North Korea had a deterrent. The deterrent is not nuclear weapons. The deterrent is massed artillery at the DMZ, the Militarized Zone, aimed at Seoul, the capital of South Korea, and at American, maybe tens of thousands of American troops right south of the border. And unless the Pentagon can figure out some way of taking out that artillery with precision-guided weapons or something, North Korea has a deterrent, and Iraq had nothing. You know, I mean, they knew perfectly well that Iraq was. You know, they knew probably every pocket knife that was in every square inch of Iraq by that time. It was completely destroyed. So that's the second factor. But yeah, the first factor's right. On the other hand, North Korea also has geostrategic significance, which is not unimportant the way the world's shaping up now. It's not so much North Korea itself as its position within Northeast Asia. I mean, the Northeast Asian region is the most dynamic economic region in the world. It includes two major industrial societies, Japan and South Korea, and China is increasingly becoming an industrial society, has enormous resources. Siberia has all kind of resources, including oil. It's got, I think, about close to a third of world gross domestic product, way more than the United States. It has half the foreign exchange of the world, has enormous financial resources, and it's growing very fast, much faster than any other region, including the United States. Its trade is increasing internally, and it's connecting to the Southeast Asian countries, something that's called ASEAN plus three, Southeast Asian countries plus China, Japan, and South Korea. And then with the resource areas of Siberia. Well, you know, if you take a look at the geography, pipelines are being built from the resource centers to the industrial centers. Some of them would go naturally right to South Korea, but that means through North Korea. So pipelines through North Korea, if this Trans-Siberian Railway is extended, as is surely planned, it would go probably the same route through North Korea to South Korea. So North Korea happens to be in a fairly strategic position with regard to this integrated area. Well, the U.S. is not particularly happy about Northeast Asian economic integration, just as it's always been very ambivalent about Europe. It has always been a concern that Europe might go off on an independent course. It might be what used to be called a third force, you know, could go off on its own. And quite a lot of policy planning from the Second World War until the present reflects that concern. Actually, it was expressed with his usual crudity by Henry Kissinger very well. 30 years ago, 1973, was called the Year of Europe. You know, Europe was finally reconstituting. And Kissinger gave an important address, which is called the Year of Europe address, in which the main theme was that Europe shouldn't get that European unification, everything is wonderful, but Europe shouldn't get too big for its britches. It should recognize that it has only regional responsibilities within the overall framework of order managed by the United States. And a lot of policy has been designed to prevent Europe from moving off on its own. It's a lot of the purpose of NATO, in fact. Same issues are arising for Northeast Asia. So the world really has three major economic centers: North America, Northeast Asia, and Europe. And in one dimension, the military dimension, the United States is in a class by itself, but not in others.
You mentioned one national security advisor. Another was Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, and today a frequent talk show pundit. He's on all of the TV shows. He contends that the main task facing the managers of American empire is to, quote, to prevent collusion and maintain dependence among the vassals, keep tributaries pliant and protected, and to keep the barbarians from coming together, unquote.
That's pretty frank. Lord Curzon would have been pleased. Yeah, that's basically correct. That's a cruder version of what Kissinger said. I'll take back my insult. And that's, you know, it's called, there's even international relations theory, that's called realism. You know, you prevent groupings of powers from getting together to oppose a hegemonic power. Now, that's part of the reason why conservative international relations specialists were deeply concerned and highly critical of U.S. policy, even during the Clinton years. They were people like Samuel Huntington and Robert Jervis. He was then head of the chair of the American Political Science Association. Other well-known so-called realist scholars were warning that U.S. policies are creating a situation in which much of the world will regard the United States as what they called a rogue state, and will a threat to their existence, and will form coalitions against it. This is in the Clinton years. This is not Bush. That's before the national security strategy.
Joseph Schumpeter, who was an Austrian economist, wrote an essay in 1919 called The Sociology of Imperialisms. And he wrote, "There's no corner of the world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. When it was utterly impossible to contrive such an interest, why then it was the national honor that was insulted. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their indubitably aggressive designs." So if one were to land, like your fictive journalist from Mars, on the United States today, or view the United States today, and insert the U.S. in this Schumpeter essay, every time he says Rome, insert the U.S., might you be coming close to some understanding of what's going on?
That's one reason why that quote's been reprinted. Actually, I just reprinted it too, but the Monthly Review did reprint that quote in a fairly recent issue I think it must have been an editorial referring to the national security strategy, precisely because it is so apposite. You know, you just change the words, and it's quite right. I mean, one of the standard arguments for going to war these days is to maintain credibility. So there's cases where resources aren't at stake. It's credibility that's at stake.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky on imperialism. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling the following toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. 1977. Stay tuned at the end for complete details on ordering.
So it takes the bombing of Serbia in 1999. This is Clinton again. What was the point of that? I mean, the standard line is it was to prevent ethnic cleansing, but to hold that, you just have to invert the chronology. I mean, uncontroversially, the ethnic cleansing followed the bombing, and furthermore, it was the anticipated consequence of it. So that can't have been the reason. What was the reason? Well, in fact, if you look carefully, Clinton and Blair said at the time, and it's now conceded by many in retrospect, that it was to maintain credibility, to make it clear who's the boss. Serbia was defying the orders of the boss, and you don't do that. And it was, again, defenseless, so you don't lose anything, and you can make up a humanitarian case if you like. You always can. That's the reason, maintain credibility. And there are plenty of other cases like this. In fact, it's very common, and it should be familiar to anyone who watches television programs about the mafia. I mean, a very large part of the structure of the mafia is that Don has to make sure that people understand that he's the boss. You don't cross him. You may send out your goons to beat somebody to pulp, not because you want his resources, but because he's standing up to you. That's back to Cuba again. It was Castro's successful defiance of the United States, which made it necessary to carry out terrorist actions aimed at regime change. You don't defy the master, and everyone else has to understand that. If the rumor is spread around that you can get away with defying the master, you're in trouble.
You've carefully examined declassified State Department documents over the years, and I was wondering if you could talk about whether you see any persistent themes and patterns. And let me just read one that you've cited on a number of occasions. State Department Policy Planning Study 23, issued in 1948. George Kennan apparently wrote it. And he says, the U.S. has about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. In this situation, we cannot fail to be the object of envy and resentment. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriment to our national security.
That's a rather frank statement, and it's an interesting document because that whole document, if you look at it, was from the State Department planning staff, which Kennan headed, and it kind of laid out plans, ideas about how various parts of the world should fit into this general strategy. This particular comment happened to be specifically about Asia, but it's general, and it's not unlike Schumpeter or British imperialism or anything else. Yeah, that's to quote Nehru again, it's just inherent in domination. Kennan was to be respected for having said it publicly. It's too bad that he kept it secret, instead of telling people. Remember that he was at the soft humanist end of the planning sector. In fact, was thrown out a couple of years later because he was considered not harsh enough, replaced by Paul Nitze as much tougher.
A few years before Kennan's document, the U.S. developed something called the Grand Area Strategy. Could you tell what was that about?
This is pretty quite interesting. There's actually only one good book about this by Larry Shoup and William Minter called Imperial Brain Trust. It's not an official government policy. These are programs run by the Council on Foreign Relations with participation of the State Department from 1939 to 1945. And it's planning the post-war world. This begins when the Second World War begins and then goes on. They're quite interesting. One reason they're interesting is because the policies that were actually carried out are very similar to those they discussed. Not surprisingly, it's many of the same people in charge and the same interests represented. It's a book well worth reading. It's been bitterly attacked, naturally, which is a pretty good sign that it's worth reading. And no reviews and that sort of thing. It's kept secret. There's very little scholarship on this. Theirs is the only one, but it's really important material. It's obvious from its just taking a look at who was doing it. Well, if the basic idea was that it actually reads rather like the National Security Strategy. Some recent publications compared the statements, the 2002 strategy.
Of the Bush administration.
And this is kind of Roosevelt liberals, remember. We're kind of like the opposite end of the planning spectrum. It says the United States will have to emerge from the war as the world dominant power, and we'll have to make sure that there is no challenge to its dominance anywhere, ever. And it'll have to do this by a program of complete rearmament, which will leave the United States in a position of overwhelming strength in the world. Goes on like that. In the early stages of the war, they were planning for the grand area that you mentioned. It was supposed to be the non-German world. They assumed in the early stages that Germany would remain, Nazi Germany would partially win the war, at least. It would control most of Europe. So there would be a German world. And then the question is, well, what about the non-German world? And they said, well, that has to be turned into what they called a grand area run by the United States, which will, and then they went through a geopolitical, geostrategic analysis, where what resources do we need, and so on and so forth. The grand area would include, at a minimum, the entire Western Hemisphere, the Far East, and the former British Empire, the maximum, everything. That's the early stage of the war. As it became clear by 1943, roughly, that Germany was going to be defeated, mainly by the Russians, but probably would be defeated. It wasn't certain, but looked more likely. They began extending the policies beyond to try to hold on to as much of Eurasia as possible, assuming there wouldn't be a German world. And those policies are later extend into things like the policy planning carried out in the early post-war period in many respects right till today. These are pretty natural natural and sensible plans of analysts who are thinking in terms of world domination for the interests that they represent. Of course, they will say and probably believe that they're just laboring for the benefit of the ordinary person, but the Romans that Schumpeter's talking about would have said the same thing and also believed it.
William Appleman Williams, who was a historian, wrote a book called Empire as a Way of Life, and he writes very simply, now let's talk about America and how we benefit from empire, if we can use that collective pronoun there. He writes, very simply, Americans of the 20th century liked empire for the same reasons their ancestors had favored it in the 18th and 19th century. It provided them with renewable opportunities, wealth, and other benefits and satisfactions, including a psychological sense of well-being and power. What do you think of Williams's analysis?
I think he's correct about the United States, but remember, the United States was not a normal empire in the European style, so it wasn't like the British Empire. The United States, why are we here? The English colonists who came to the United States didn't do what they did in India. They didn't create a facade of the native population behind which they would rule. They wiped out the native population. That's rather different. So the indigenous population of the what's now the United States was, the word that the founding fathers used was exterminated. I mean, not totally, but that was what was considered the right thing to do. They replaced them and became a kind of a, it's a settler state, not an imperial state. And the expansion over the national territory was that way all along, including the taking over of large parts of Mexico. The next, they wanted, back in the 1820s, one of the earliest issues in U.S. foreign policy was Cuba. It was assumed in the 1820s by Thomas Jefferson and John Quincy Adams and others, that's the next step in expansion. But the British were in the way. The British fleet was much too powerful, and they couldn't take Cuba at the time. John Quincy Adams made a famous statement, I think the Secretary of State at the time, which he said that we should back off and Cuba will fall into our hands by the laws, like a ripe fruit by the laws of political gravitation, meaning that sooner or later we'll become more powerful, the British will become weaker, the deterrent will be gone, and we'll be able to pluck the ripe fruit, which happened in 1898 under the guise of liberation. Every extension up until the Second World War was not establishing traditional colonies. I mean, Hawaii was taken over from its own population at the same time, 1898, stolen by force and guile. But then the native population was pretty much replaced. They weren't colonized. Not totally. They're still there. But it became essentially taken over rather than colonized. The Philippines was different. The Philippines was more like a colony. So Williams's comments are correct, but I think they refer to a different sort of imperial system. If you look at the traditional empires, say the British Empire, it's not so clear that the population of Britain gained from it. I mean, there have been, it's a really very difficult topic to study, kind of cost-benefit analysis of empire, but there have been a couple of attempts to study it, and for what they're worth, the general range of conclusions is that the costs and the benefits probably pretty much balanced out. That is, if you take the, if you consider the empires are costly, like running Iraq is not cheap. Somebody's paying. People who the corporations that destroyed Iraq and the corporations who were rebuilding it. They're getting paid by the American taxpayer in both cases. So we pay them to destroy the country, and then we pay them to rebuild it. Well, those are gifts from the U.S. taxpayer to U.S. corporations. I mean, indirectly, happened to affect Iraq.
I don't understand. You mean how do country corporations like Halliburton and Bechtel...
Who's paying Halliburton? Mm-hmm. You and I are. I mean, they're paid by U.S. taxpayers.
But how did they contribute to the destruction of Iraq?
The military system that bombed Iraq destroyed it. No. Well, who paid for them? Same taxpayers. So first you destroy them, then you rebuild them. And it's a transfer of wealth from the general population to narrow sectors of the population. In fact, even if you look at the famous Marshall Plan, it's pretty much what it was. It's talked about as an act of unimaginable benevolence and so on. But whose benevolence? It's the benevolence of the American taxpayer who of the $13 billion of Marshall Plan aid, about $2 billion went right to the U.S. oil companies. That's part of the effort to shift Europe from a coal-based to an oil-based economy, in part so that it would be more dependent on the United States. It had plenty of coal, didn't have oil. So there's $2 billion of the $13. You look at the rest of it, and very little of that money left the United States. It goes from one pocket to another. In fact, if you look more closely, the Marshall Plan aid to France just about covered the costs of the French effort to reconquer Indochina. So the U.S. taxpayer wasn't rebuilding France. They were paying the French to buy American weapons to crush the Indochinese. Partially the same was true about that Marshall Plan aid to Holland in the early stage and Indonesia. So these, you really take a look, it's a complex flow of aid and benefits. Going back to the British Empire, the studies of it have suggested that the costs to the British people may have been about on a par with the benefits that the British people got from it. However, it's a transfer internally to the guys who were running the East India Company, fantastic wealth, to the British sailors who were, you know, dying out in the wilderness somewhere, not a serious cost. So it's part of class war internally to a large extent. And I think to a large extent, that's the way empires work. There's a big element of it is internal class war.
Well, it may be somewhat easy to measure the cost in lives, you know, number of soldiers killed and how much money spent. How does one measure or even talk about moral degradation?
You can't give measures to that, but it's very real and very significant. I mean, it just erodes. That's part of the reason why imperial systems or any system of domination, you know, even a patriarchal family, anything, always has a cover of benevolence. We're back to the racism again. Why do you have to present yourself as somehow doing it for the benefit of the people you're crushing? Well, otherwise you have to face the moral degradation. And one of the ways of covering for it is to say, well, I'm really, an altruist working for the benefit of all. Again, the typical, Hollywood joke taken seriously, I suppose, about the corporate executive who's laboring day and night for the benefit of the ordinary person and, you know, that kind of thing. If we're honest about it, human relations are often like that. And imperial systems, almost always, it's hard to find an imperial system where the intellectual class didn't laud its benevolence. That's normal. Even the worst monsters. I mean, when Hitler was taking over, dismembering Czechoslovakia, it was done with wonderful rhetoric about bringing peace to the ethnic groups who were in conflict and making sure that they could all live happily together, under German supervision, and which was benign, and so on and so forth. You really have to labor to find an exception to that. And, of course, it's true in the United States.
Mark Twain is known for writing Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, but he was a staunch opponent of U.S. wars of aggression a century ago. He was involved in something called the Anti-Imperialist League. Look at what he wrote in The Mysterious Stranger. Next, the statesman will invent cheap lies, putting the blame on the nation that is attacked, and every man will be glad of those conscious soothing falsities, and will diligently study them, and refuse to examine any refutations of them, and thus he will by and by convince himself that the war is just, and will thank God for the better sleep he enjoys after this process of grotesque self-deception. Direct quote from Mark Twain. Why is that aspect of Mark Twain almost totally occluded?
Well, that's an interesting story. For the last years of his life, one of his main activities was vigorous involvement in opposition to the Philippine War and the Anti-Imperialist League and so on. And he has wonderful essays, anti-imperialist essays, but you don't find reference to them. Actually, I think the first publication of them, I mean, they did appear here and there, but the first general publication of them was in a book by Jim Zwick about 10 years ago. Some university press published a collection of Mark Twain's anti-imperialist essays. And if my memory is correct, the introduction by Zwick says that the standard biographies don't include this material, although it wasn't secret, you know. Why? Well, you know, the question answers itself. You don't want people to explode the aura of benevolence in which we clothe ourselves.
Well, traditionally, if you use the word imperialism and attach the adjective American in front of it, you were immediately dismissed as some member of some far-left fringe. That has undergone a bit of a transformation in the last few years. Let's just take Michael Ignatieff, for one. He is a son of a Canadian diplomat, now at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard, where he is a professor of human rights policy and director of the Carr Center. Ignatieff seems to be a particular favorite of the New York Times. In the Sunday Times magazine of September 7, 2003, "Why Are We in Iraq?" is the title of his article. He writes, "New rules of intervention proposed by the U.S. and abided by it would end the canard that the U.S., not its enemy, is the rogue state." What is Ignatieff getting at here, that this is a canard, that the U.S. is a rogue state?
If we define rogue state in terms of any kind of principles like violation of international law or aggression or atrocities or human rights violations and so on, the U.S. qualifies rather well, as you would expect of the most powerful state in the world. Just as Britain did, just as France did, and every one of them wrote the same kind of garbage that you're quoting from Ignatieff. So France was carrying out a civilizing mission when the Minister of War was saying that they're going to have to exterminate the natives in Algeria, which they proceeded to try to do, and on, even the Nazis. You go to the absolute depths, and you'll find the same sentiments expressed. When the Japanese fascists were conquering China and carrying out huge atrocities, the rhetoric, like the Nanking Massacre and stuff, the rhetoric behind it was just, it brings tears to your eyes. They were creating an earthly paradise in which the peoples of Asia would work together, and Japan would sacrifice itself for their benefit so that they would all have peace and prosperity, and Japan would protect them from the communist bandits while they go and move on to the earthly paradise and so on. Again, I'm a little surprised that some editor at the Times or dean at Harvard or something doesn't see that it's a little odd to just be repeating what has been said over and over again by the worst monsters. Why is it different now? Notice that, incidentally, this one of the great advantages of being a respectable intellectual is you never need any evidence for anything you say. So you go through those articles and try to find some evidence to support the conclusions. It's not that it's not there, it's just that it would be ridiculous to put it in. It's as if you wrote that 2 and 2 is 4 and then somebody said, "Where's your evidence?" In order to make it to the peak of respectability, you have to understand that it's faintly absurd even to ask for evidence of praise of those with power. It's just automatic. Of course they're magnificent. Maybe they made some mistakes in the past, but now they're magnificent. And to look for evidence for that is like looking for evidence for the truths of arithmetic. So there never is any.
Gramsci wrote in 1925, "A main obstacle to change is the reproduction by the dominating forces of elements of the hegemonic ideology. It's an important and urgent task to develop alternative interpretations of reality." How does someone listening to this program develop an alternative interpretation of reality, as Gramsci suggests?
I respect Gramsci a lot, but I think it's possible to paraphrase that comment, namely, just tell the truth. Instead of repeating ideological fanaticism, dismantle it, try to find out the truth, and tell the truth. Does that say anything different? And it's something any one of us can do. Remember, it's part of the intellectuals internalize the conception that they have to make things look complicated. Otherwise, what are they around for? But it's worth asking yourself how much of it really is complicated. Now, Gramsci's a very admirable person, but take that state and try to translate it into simple English. Is it complicated to understand or to know how to act?
A certain MIT professor is celebrating his 75th birthday on December 7th. Do you have any information on that you could possibly share?
I don't think there is such a person.
There's no one on the faculty here.
There may be somebody who's having a 75th birthday, but he's not celebrating it. You got to be careful with this language. Just because you're an intellectual doesn't mean you can use big words.
Thanks very much, Noam Chomsky.
You were just listening to Noam Chomsky on imperialism. I talked with him in his office at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on September 11th, 2003. Noam Chomsky is an internationally renowned scholar and activist. The Guardian of London calls him one of the radical heroes of our age. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, the Boulder, Colorado-based award-winning independent weekly series. AR, since its inception, has made a special effort to record and archive Professor Chomsky's work. You can access the Chomsky archive, as well as our complete catalog, on our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website is alternativeradio.org. Over the years, I've had the privilege to do a series of interview books with Professor Chomsky. The two most recent ones are Propaganda and the Public Mind and The Common Good. They're both available from AR. To place a credit card order for the complete one-hour program you just heard, Noam Chomsky on Imperialism, as well as to order the books Propaganda and the Public Mind and the Common Good, just call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can send in your check. Printed transcripts are $9. CDs and cassettes are $15. Please specify the format you'd like. Our address, AR.